My name is Michael McCusker. Today is going to be a rather, you might say, Occupy-packed program. And I would like to start off with a letter that I've written to the Daily Astorian, which may or may not print it. And I should hesitate to say that at least this letter is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the entire universe, or multiverses. If anyone thinks police attacks, arrests, and displacements in several American cities have disintegrated the Occupy Wall Street movement, they should be reminded that the anti-Vietnam War movement was attacked hundreds of times all over the country by police and National Guards, but it never quit, and ultimately, despite official repulsion, greatly contributed not only to America's withdrawal from the war, but also changed the country. The Occupy movement is not simply related to real estate, but of the minds and hearts of increasing millions of Americans. A revolutionary method of organizing political and cultural change in a horizontal rather than hierarchical manner. Sheila Harper of Astoria expresses it this way. We are pushing up against real change. It is time to change our thinking from material wealth to a personal and social wealth. And as an Occupy protester said in New York City, we are the 99%. We are the blood of this country. This country can't live without us. The only real distinction of this country is not wealth or power, but the fact the great majority of ordinary people who do not have much wealth are the fundamental source of government power. Yet the wealthy minority dangerously fool themselves that their money entitles them to authoritarian control as a corollary to wealth. This beleaguered democracy must be reformed or replaced with structures of greater personal liberties that are simultaneously more civically, politically, and economically equitable, a delicate balance that is always fragile and subject to deformity. Our Constitution contains much of what is needed to repair the crushing inequity that impairs our society, but it tends to be used to protect privilege and the dominance of whoever possesses it. Yet the Arab Spring has shown that once certain dynamics fall into place, change occurs rapidly, particularly when hopes of freedom and equality are given a chance. Capitalist democracy is falling apart from its own contradictions, just as Russian communism did. Democracy and capitalism were extolled as the same principle during the Cold War. The instant Russia collapsed, the rich in America revived the ancient war against the non-rich, which is greatly intensified, especially following the collapse and bailouts of Wall Street. The vast majority of American citizens are oppressed by a wealthy gentry whose sole purpose is to use money to make more money rather than produce products and pay wages, and believes that its own interests are all that matter. Money is sucked up from everybody else to the wealthy caste, who use it for the specific purpose of further enriching themselves in financial markets. As Will Rogers famously said, there is as much money as there always has been, but fewer got it. An accelerating disparity between the wealthy and everyone else, and the use of the law and politics to oppress the deprived, endangers the remaining democracy and equity in this country. Economic inequality is not a natural phenomenon, but is premeditated policy, such as is first-degree murder. The bankers and financiers who caused the economic catastrophe that has plunged millions of Americans into jobless and homeless poverty have emerged incredibly more wealthy, essentially because the ordinary citizens they have pillaged have unwillingly and without consent been forced to bail them out with tax money they have lost control over. Instead of being tried as criminals, these wealthy elites purchase not only the corrupt minds and shriveled souls of elected lawmakers, but also the law itself. It is pertinent that Astorians participate in the Occupy movement. After all, John Jacob Astor was not only America's first millionaire, he was also its first multimillionaire. He made his money in furs, real estate, he was called the nation's first slumlord, and high finance, and was most likely an original investor on Wall Street. And if that is not enough, some of his descendants purchased English royalty in contravention of America's cherished claim of classlessness. The latest Lord Astor visited Astoria this past summer for its bicentennial celebration. I used to be a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Actually, once VVAW, always VVAW. And I am also now a member of Occupied Astoria, worldwide. And that is a letter I wrote to the Daily Astorian, which may or may not print it. And I'd like to read something that Occupy Astoria, Oregon has sort of put together. Who are we? We are individuals from all walks of life and situations that see the upcoming disasters in our economic systems, legal systems, and political systems and demand immediate change. Why are we doing this? The public has fallen asleep. We are here to wake them up and make them aware of what is really going on with our money, security, government, and future. We are heading for a disaster. We have to change direction now. What do we want? Money out of politics and sound financial functioning of a government for the people and by the people. A true democracy, not financially directed government. You matter. Be heard. Join us. And from the Occupy Washington, D.C., October 2011 Movement Steering Committee, and these are things that they sent out all over the country for other Occupies to take a look at. And as a matter of fact, Occupy Astoria is going to try to put together its credo, you might say, 2 days after Thanksgiving on November 26th, Saturday. We're not quite sure where we're going to meet, but we will let you know, anyone who is interested. And we are going to hash out all these things for quite a few hours, I suppose. So from Occupy Washington, D.C., 15 points that they have come up with. Corporatism, number one. Firmly established that money is not speech. Corporations are not people. Only people have constitutional rights. End corporate influence over the political process. Protect people and the environment from damage by corporations. Two. Wars and militarism. End wars and occupations. End private for-profit military contractors. Reduce the national security state and end the weapons export industry. War crimes, crimes against humanity, and crimes against peace must be addressed and those responsible held accountable under international law. Three, human rights. End exploitation of people in the U.S. and abroad. End discrimination in all forms, equal civil rights and due process for all people. Four, workers' rights and jobs. All working-age people have the right to safe, just, non-discriminatory, and dignified working conditions, a sustainable living wage, paid leave, and economic protection. Five, government. All processes of the three branches of government should be accountable to international law, transparent, and follow the rule of law. People have the right to participate in decisions which affect them. Six, elections. All citizens 18 and older have the right to vote without barriers. All candidates have the right to be heard and to run, and all votes should be counted. Seven, criminal justice and prisons. End private for-profit prisons. Adopt evidence-based drug policy. Prisoners have the right to humane and just conditions with a focus on rehabilitation and reintegration into society, abolish the death penalty. 8. Health care. Create a national, universal, and publicly financed comprehensive health system. 9. Education. All people have the right to a high-quality, publicly funded, and broad education from preschool through vocational training or university. 10. Housing. All people have the right to affordable and safe housing. 11. Environment. Adopt policies which effectively create a carbon-free and radioactive-free energy economy and which respects the rights of nature. 12. Finance and the economy. End policies which foster a wealth divide and move to a localized and democratic financial system. Reform taxes so that they are progressive and provide goods, monetary gain, and services for the people. 13. Media. Airwaves and the internet are public goods. Require that media be honest, accurate, and accountable to the people. 14. Food and water. Create systems that protect the land and water. Create local and sustainable food networks and practices. 15. Transportation. Provide affordable, clean, and convenient public transportation and safe spaces for pedestrian and non-automobile travel. And those 15 points were from the Occupy Washington, D.C. Movement Steering Committee, which will be part of what we will discuss on the 26th when we find some place to discuss them. And by the way, today being the 2-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, here in Astoria, a protest rally is scheduled to take place from noon to 1 p.m. at the Astoria Post Office at 8th and Commercial, and from 4 to 5 p.m. at the Department of Human Services building, 450 Marine Drive, Astoria. And Tom Hartman gave me a couple of things this morning as I walked in the door virtually. And this one is from the Occupy Wall Street PR team. You can't evict an idea whose time has come. 2 months ago, just 200 of us set up an encampment at Wall Street's doorstep. Since then, Occupy Wall Street has become a national and even international symbol, with similarly styled occupations popping up in cities and towns across America and around the world. A growing popular movement has significantly altered the national narrative about our economy, our democracy, and our future. Late into last night, and this is from November 15th, we on the Occupy Wall Street PR team were reflecting on the successes, challenges, and the aims of our movement up to this point. Over the weekend, some 20 writers sent us their thoughts on their experience with direct democracy and the evolution of the movement. We sat in awe for a moment at the various perspectives, backgrounds, and motives of each Occupy Wall Street contributor and their journey through this burgeoning movement. At exactly 12:54 a.m., as the PR working group was culling final articles for this very editorial page, the outreach team nearby was developing orientation materials for the new initiative, Occupy Your Block, and the movement building working group engaged in a conference call about national plans for the day of action on 17 November, today. An alert rippled room to room. At 1:20 a.m., our phones started buzzing off the tables, overloaded with text messages. 3 blocks away and within seconds, we knew that hundreds of riot police were arriving, dump trucks rolling in, subway stops shutting down, and the Brooklyn Bridge had been closed. Via Twitter, we knew our fellow occupiers were chanting, "This is what a police state looks like." Half the people in the off-site office space ran to Liberty Square, leaving their laptops, their wallets, their phones even behind. PR Working Group member Jason Ahmadi texted the team from a police van full of 13 arrestees, and we soon discovered that NYC council member Yadanis Rodriguez had been arrested and was bleeding from the head. One after another, text messages alerted us to the effect that those who not yet arrested at Liberty Square were being chased up Broadway towards Chinatown. Some of our people headed to Foley Square by City Hall, some to Washington Square, and others to Judson Memorial Church, where so many of our meetings have been held these past weeks. Occupiers, undeterred by the unprovoked brutality rained on them by police, instantly regrouped and launched a fresh General Assembly, which took place at Foley Square. More General Assemblies are planned throughout the whole week, I should think, even though this says throughout the day. An interfaith gathering planned for 9 a.m. aimed to offer comfort and encouragement to the occupiers. At 2:43 a.m., the New York Observer reported that photographers with credentials were barred from Liberty Square. Seconds later, the director of editorial operations at Gawker reported that a CBS News chopper was ordered out of the sky by the NYPD. New York Times journalist Jared Mollison went to jail in zip ties. And 20 minutes later, we heard the NYPD was cutting down trees in Liberty Square, and from our office space we could hear the deployment of a long-range acoustic device, a sound cannon. To be certain, we could see and feel that this operation had been planned carefully to exclude all media coverage, sending out a loud message about how dissent will be treated in this democracy. But we are not deterred. Our spirits are high, our resolve indomitable. This burgeoning movement is more than a protest, more than an occupation, and more than any tactic. The us in this movement is far broader than those who are able to participate in physical occupations. The movement is everyone who sends supplies, everyone who talks to their friends and families about the underlying issues, everyone who takes some form of action to get involved in this civic process. This moment is nothing short of America rediscovering the strength we hold when we come together as citizens to take action to address crises that impact us all. Such a movement cannot be evicted. Some politicians may physically remove us from public spaces, our spaces, and physically they may succeed. But we are engaged in a battle over ideas. Our idea is that our political structures should serve us, the people, all of us, not just those who have amassed great wealth and power. We believe this idea resonates with so many of us because Congress, beholden to Wall Street, has ignored the powerful stories pouring out from the homes and hearts of our neighbors, stories of unrelenting economic suffering. Our dream for a democracy in which we matter is why so many people have come to identify with Occupy Wall Street and the 99% movement. As of filing this morning, and this is November 15th, with 100 people sitting in jail, a judge has declared that we have a right to return with our belongings, while Mayor Bloomberg insists that the park will remain closed. It does not matter. We will reclaim our streets block by block. We will occupy our public spaces everywhere, knowing that this idea cannot be evicted. And this is from the PR team, and their names are J.M. Smucker, Rebecca Mansky, Karanja Gakua, Linnea M. Palmer-Patton, Kanine Holder, and William Jesse of the Occupy Wall Street PR team. And to continue on, this is what revolution looks like, also posted November 15th, and this is by Chris Hedges. Once upon a time, a war correspondent in the Iraq War. Welcome to the revolution. Our elites have exposed their hand. They have nothing to offer. They can destroy, but they cannot build. They can repress, but they cannot lead. They can steal, but they cannot share. They can talk, but they cannot speak. They are as dead and useless to us as the water-soaked books, tents, sleeping bags, suitcases, food boxes, and clothes that were tossed by sanitation workers Tuesday morning into garbage trucks in New York City. They have no ideas, no plans, and no vision for the future. Our decaying corporate regime has strutted in Portland, Oakland, and New York with their baton-wielding cops into a fool's paradise. They think they can clean up the mess, and that's a quote, always employing the language of personal hygiene and public security by making us disappear. They think we will all go home and accept their corporate nation, a nation where crime and government policy have become indistinguishable, where nothing in America, including the ordinary citizen, is deemed by those in power worth protecting or preserving, where corporate oligarchs awash in hundreds of millions of dollars are permitted to loot and pillage the last shreds of collective wealth, human capital, and natural resources. A nation where the poor do not eat and workers do not work. A nation where the sick die and children go hungry. A nation where the consent of the governed and the voice of the people is a cruel joke. Get back into your cages, they are telling us. Return to watching the lies, absurdities, trivia, and celebrity gossip we feed you in 24-hour cycles on television. Invest your emotional energy in the vast system of popular entertainment. Run up your credit card debt. Pay your loans. Be thankful for the scraps we toss. Chant back to us our phrases about democracy, greatness, and freedom. Vote in our rigged political theater. Send your young men and women to fight and die in useless, unwinnable wars that provide corporations with huge profits. Stand by mutely as our bipartisan congressional super committee, either through consensus or cynical dysfunction, plunges you into a society without basic social services, including unemployment benefits. Pay for the crimes of Wall Street. The rogues gallery of Wall Street crooks, such as Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs, Howard Milstein at New York Private Bank and Trust, the media tycoon Rupert Murdoch, the Koch brothers, and Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, no doubt think it's over. They think it is back to the business of harvesting what is left of America to swell their personal and corporate fortunes. But they no longer have any concept of what is happening around them. They are as mystified and clueless about these uprisings as the courtiers at Versailles or in the Forbidden City, who never understood until the very end that their world was collapsing, the Forbidden City being in Beijing, China. The billionaire mayor of New York, enriched by a deregulated Wall Street, is unable to grasp why people would spend 2 months sleeping in an open park and marching on banks. He says he understands that the Occupy protests are cathartic and entertaining, and those are quotes, as if demonstrating against the pain of being homeless and unemployed is a form of therapy or diversion, but that it is time to let the adults handle the affairs of state. Democratic and Republican mayors, along with their parties, have sold us out, but for them, this is the beginning of the end. The historian Crane Brinton, in his book Anatomy of a Revolution, laid out the common route to revolution. The preconditions for successful revolution, Brinton argued, are discontent that affects nearly all social classes, widespread feelings of entrapment and despair, unfulfilled expectations, a unified solidarity in opposition to a tiny power elite, a refusal by scholars and thinkers to continue to defend the actions of the ruling class, an inability of government to respond to the basic needs of citizens, a steady loss of will within the power elite itself, and defections from the inner circle, a crippling isolation that leaves the power elite without any allies or outside support, and finally, a financial crisis. Our corporate elite, as far as Brinton was concerned, has amply fulfilled these preconditions. But it is Brinton's next observation that is most worth remembering. Revolutions always begin, he wrote, by making impossible demands that if the government met would mean the end of the old configurations of power. The second stage, the one we have entered now, is the unsuccessful attempt by the power elite to quell the unrest and discontent through physical acts of repression. I have seen my share of revolts, insurgencies, and revolutions, from the guerrilla conflicts in the 1980s in Central America to the civil wars in Algeria, the Sudan, and Yemen, to the Palestinian uprising, to the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania, as well as the wars in former Yugoslavia. George Orwell wrote that all tyrannies rule through fraud and force, but that once the fraud is exposed, they must rely exclusively on force. We have now entered the era of naked force. The vast million-person bureaucracy of the internal security and surveillance state will not be used to stop terrorism, but to try and stop us. Despotic regimes in the end collapse internally. Once the foot soldiers who are ordered to carry out acts of repression, such as the clearing of parks or arresting or even shooting demonstrators, no longer obey orders, the old regime swiftly crumbles. When the aging East German dictator Erich Honecker was unable to get paratroopers to fire on protesting crowds in Leipzig, the regime was finished. The same refusal to employ violence doomed the communist governments in Prague and Bucharest. I watched in December 1989 as the army general that the dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu had depended on to crush protests condemned him to death on Christmas Day. Tunisia's Ben Ali and Egypt's Hosni Mubarak lost power once they could no longer count on the security forces to fire into crowds. The process of defection among the ruling class and security forces is slow and often imperceptible. These defections are advanced through a rigid adherence to nonviolence, a refusal to respond to police provocation, and a verbal respect for the blue uniformed police, no matter how awful they can be while wading into a crowd and using batons as battering rams against human bodies. The resignations of Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan's deputy Sharon Cornu and the mayor's legal advisor and longtime friend Dan Siegel in protest over the clearing of the Oakland encampment are some of the first cracks in the edifice. Support Occupy Oakland, not the 1% and its government facilitators, Siegel tweeted after his resignation. There were times when I entered the ring as a boxer and knew, as did the spectators, that I was woefully mismatched. Ringers, experienced boxers in need of a tune-up or a little practice, would go to the clubs where semi-pros fought, lie about their long professional fight records, and toy with us. Those fights became about something other than winning. They became about dignity and self-respect. You fought to say something about who you were as a human being. These bouts were punishing, physically brutal, and demoralizing. You would get knocked down and stagger back up. You would reel backward from a blow that felt like a cement block. You would taste the saltiness of your blood on your lips. Your vision would blur. Your ribs, the back of your neck, and your abdomen would ache. Your legs would feel like lead. But the longer you held on, the more the crowd in the club turned in your favor. No one, even you, thought you could win. But then, every once in a while, the ringer would get overconfident. He would get careless. He would become a victim of his own hubris. And you would find deep within yourself some new burst of energy, some untapped strength, and with the fury of the dispossessed, bring him down. I have not put on a pair of boxing gloves for 30 years, but I felt this twinge of euphoria again in my stomach this morning, this utter certainty that the impossible is possible, this realization that the mighty will fall. And that was by Chris Hedges, and it was written on the 15th. And of course, this morning he's speaking of is when the cops came in and cleared out the occupiers from the park in New York, that private, so-called public park. The Occupy Astoria movement, still in its birth pangs, as is most of the Occupy movements throughout the country and the world, but this is indeed the birth of something very, very important, I believe. And something that has to be seen to its end. And it must involve every one of us possible, if indeed we are to live up to our bills of rights and this liberty and justice we thought we stood for in this country. And this has been Michael McCusker. Next week is Thanksgiving. I suppose I'll be here if the sky doesn't fall or truck run me down, or I slip and plunge into the river and wash out across the bar into the Pacific Ocean.